From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear about how gerrymandering in Wisconsin can impact pandemic response. Then we chat with the author of The Giver about how her books are helping kids navigate today's world.
Books of the sort that I write do play the role of presenting the questions and making them available to kids for discussion.
Plus, a local respiratory therapist describes her experience caring for COVID-19 patients out east.
There were a lot of positive cases of COVID-19 and a handful of admissions all coming at once. It was a bit overwhelming. Lots of coding, cardiac arrest, people not surviving, lots of deaths.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cases of coronavirus are surging across Wisconsin, breaking records for the state. The White House Coronavirus Task Force now considers Wisconsin a red zone. Despite the rise in cases and hospitalizations, most establishments are open and welcoming mask customers in. Governor Tony Evers recently extended a statewide mask mandate in hopes of slowing the spread of the virus. The governor has faced backlash from the legislature about his executive orders in the past, and this time is no different. David Daley said the sparring between Wisconsin's Democratic governor and its Republican legislature all leads back to gerrymandering. Daley is the author of a book on partisan gerrymandering. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about why the gap between public health recommendations and which policies are enacted is all about district maps.
How is it that COVID-19 cases and the positivity rate can be well above what is considered safe for businesses to be open in Wisconsin, but almost all places of business are still open?
That's a great question. And I think what you have to do is you have to look at the kind of public policy that polls in your state continuously show are popular, such as wearing of masks. You had a Marquette poll earlier this year that showed 69% of voters in Wisconsin favor wearing of masks, that it was across every region of the state. And yet what you are seeing coming out of your state legislature are really the opposite. You're seeing a state legislature that is willing to sue the governor over masks, a state legislature willing to sue the governor to force a primary election to take place in April. The result of this is citizens don't have a voice. And this is largely due to the lines that were drawn to keep specific legislators in power. This is gerrymandering. These are the districts that were drawn in Wisconsin after Republicans took over in 2010 that have really locked them in power regardless of what voters want to do. In 2018, Wisconsin voters go to the polls and they elect a Democrat to the U.S. Senate. They elect a Democratic governor and replace a Republican governor in Scott Walker. They elect Democratic candidates to every statewide office, and then they give Democratic candidates about 205,000 more votes for the state assembly than Republican candidates. That's enough to move exactly one seat in the assembly toward the Democrats, and Republicans hold on to a 63-36 edge. Let me break that down. That means with 53% of the vote for Democrats, they were able to win 36% of the seats. Your district lines in Wisconsin ensure that your state legislature is not responsive to voters. It's insulated from the ballot box. It's unaccountable, and it need not change because a swing of 200,000 voters is not enough to change control. Lawmakers know this. They are able to behave in such a way as to be completely impervious to anything that the public wants, even if it's masks during a pandemic that 70% of voters back.
Governor Tony Evers has seen pushback from the state legislature when trying to place restrictions in an effort to slow the spread of the virus, as you mentioned. As we get closer to the election and the risk of the spread of coronavirus grows, how do you think politics will play a role?
I think that your state government has become completely disconnected from politics. Harvard's Electoral Integrity Project does a survey every 2 years of electoral boundaries. It's one of the many criteria in their election integrity report that tests the health of democracies. In their 2018 report, on a scale of 1 to 100, Wisconsin's boundaries got a 3. That is the worst in the nation. It's also the worst of any country in the world that is measured by the Electoral Integrity Project, and that includes authoritarian states like Venezuela, which at least got a 14. That is how unresponsive and unaccountable state government is in Wisconsin. It has been estimated that according to the very fancy and specific mathematical regression model that Republicans used in 2011 to draw these districts, that Democrats would have to win upwards of 57% of the statewide vote to even have a chance at flipping a chamber of the legislature. 57% of the vote in a very closely contested 50-50 state, that simply is the kind of wave that is not going to happen during polarized times. Republicans know this. The lines have provided them a firewall against the public will. And what you see again and again is when the governor has tried to bring them into session to do something that is popular, whether that is the special session on guns to pass background checks that 80% of citizens backed. They gaveled in and out in seconds. When he tried to bring them in on police reform, and this was even before the events in Kenosha, you had 81% of the state, according to the Marquette poll, backing a greater accountability for police misconduct. They gaveled in and out of that in seconds. When the governor tried to call a special session to force this legislature to do something about postponing an election at the height of the pandemic back in April, they gaveled in and out of that in seconds. This legislature does not care because it does not have to care. They have insulated themselves from voters. Wisconsin, as a result, more closely resembles an authoritarian state than it does a genuine representative democracy.
What are the consequences of having that level of disconnect between constituents and those supposed to represent those constituents?
John Adams used to talk about how a legislature is supposed to be a perfect replica of the people in miniature. You can hardly say that Wisconsin's legislature even comes close to being a reflection of the people. When a majority of citizens cannot change their legislature, something has gone deeply and seriously wrong in a representative democracy. And that's what's happened in Wisconsin. You have a situation in which 53% of the people can't even budge the legislature that is supposed to be the closest and most a responsive branch of government to them. That is dangerous. That is wrong. That is not a democracy. And when people can't repair their own representative government, it throws the legitimacy of the entire system into question.
Do you think people feel heard, that the power of casting a vote carries weight for the individual person in Wisconsin?
I think at the presidential level, an individual vote certainly matters. At the gubernatorial level, an individual vote certainly matters. You have seen how close those races have been. You're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of votes in the Walker-Evers race, in the Trump-Clinton race back in 2016. Certainly there are lots and lots of people who think that Wisconsin in 2020 could be the decisive electoral college state. So yes, at that level, your vote in Wisconsin is very important and matters and may matter more than, you know, I'm talking to you from Massachusetts today. You know, my vote in the presidential election doesn't matter very much in this blue state that we know how it is going to vote. But as far as your state legislature, no, that vote really does not matter. Unless if Democrats are able to break 57-58% of the vote there, the chambers are going to stay exactly as they are. You only have 5 of 99 assembly districts in Wisconsin that were within 5% in 2018 that could even be considered competitive races. So in those 5% of your districts, you might possibly have a meaningful vote. In the 34 districts that Democrats won in 2018, Republicans drew those to be so non-competitive and to be such overwhelming Democratic wins that Republican candidates did not even challenge in 30 of those 34 districts. There was no Republican challenger in those races. So you didn't even have a choice of candidates, but that was because the district was drawn in such a way that no Republican would possibly look, you know, it was drawn in such a way as to pack as many Democratic voters into as few districts as possible. And then Republican candidates look at those races and they say, well, I'm not going to bother running there because it wasn't made for me anyway. It would just be a waste of my time. There are a lot of people who will say this is because of the geography of the state. A lot of Republicans try and defend this map by saying the map is not gerrymandered. It's simply that, you know, Democrats have been concentrated in Madison and Milwaukee, and Republicans are more effectively spread out across the rest of the state. There have been academic studies of this that have been litigated in courts that have shown that the actual geographic bias is maybe 1-2% of the bias in the maps. It is not the actual reason. The reason for the bias in these maps is intentional. It is partisan. It was baked into the system, and it has done serious damage to representative democracy in the state of Wisconsin.
How does gerrymandering impact the lack of action following the increase in COVID-19 cases?
Lawmakers simply don't have to listen to the public. These lawmakers know that they are insulated from the voters. So when 70% of voters want to see masks, they know that there is no reason to do that. If these lawmakers do not want to do something, they do not have to. And the other piece of this is that gerrymandering enables more extreme representatives. Because these districts have been so rigged for one side or the other, what you tend to see is the primary becomes the election in which all of the attention is. And primaries tend to be lower turnout, and they tend to be motivated by the most extreme elements of the base of either side. So you get the most committed liberals and the most committed Republicans. And as a result, the kinds of people who are sent to Madison to legislate are more extreme. And they are most accountable to that extreme base because the voters can't actually turn them out in November. The party name next to their name is the most important thing. So as long as you have the nomination of the party that district has been drawn for, you are perfectly safe in November. The only thing you have to survive is the primary. And you survive the primary by being most attentive to the most extreme ideological piece of your party's base.
When does the need for public health action outweigh politics or the desire to either gain more power or hold on to it?
That's a great question. I think that the need for public health action ought to always be the number one concern of legislators. And what you are seeing in Wisconsin is that some sort of, culture war over what a mask represents is more important to these legislators than health. And that is because of the way they have gerrymandered these districts to really cut out the vast majority of public opinion.
When you think about the political makeup of Wisconsin, gerrymandering, and the increasing risk of COVID-19, what change are you hoping to see? Or what do you see that does make you hopeful at this time?
I think voters around the country really understand the dangers of gerrymandering. In 2018, you had voters in 5 states, including Midwestern neighbors in Ohio and Michigan, also Missouri and Colorado and Utah, that voted to rein in the ability of politicians to draw their own lines and choose their own voters. And this was widely popular. In most of those states, it passed with 60-70% of the vote. So it's Democrats, Republicans, and independents of these states really understand the importance of this, recognize that gerrymandering is cheating, that it debases democracy, and that it shouldn't be allowed. We're heading into another census year, and we redraw all of these state legislative lines again after the census year. So Wisconsin is thinking about the presidential election. Certainly the state legislators you elect in 2020 will have the power to draw these lines. Now, it appears simply by basis of the 2018 results that it's going to be very, very difficult for Democrats to, flip one of those chambers. You have a Democratic governor in the state right now, and sometimes when you have both parties with a seat at the table when it comes to redistricting, you end up with a slightly fairer map. The governor could conceivably veto maps that come out of the General Assembly next year. That said, if that happens, they would likely go to a conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court. And there is also the chance that Republicans could win supermajorities in chambers this year that would give them the ability to override any veto on these maps. So I think the state of maps in Wisconsin probably is going to remain in fairly dire shape, at least into the next decade.
David Daly is the author of a book on partisan gerrymandering. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how gerrymandering can help explain the partisan fight on restrictions for reducing the spread of coronavirus. Oh, and you know what's good in reducing the spread of COVID-19? Wearing your mask, of course. And today we are in day 3 of our fall member drive. You can donate by calling 877-583-0309 or by going to wuwm.com/give. And I'm talking about masks right now, not only because of the segment we just heard, but because if you donate at $5 a month, you can get a WUWM Public Radio Nerd face mask for yourself. Our mask is a 3-ply black cotton mask, and it also has adjustable ear loops, so that's very important to make sure it fits snugly and securely over your nose and mouth. And its soft cotton material is anti-pollution, anti-smoke, anti-dust, and it's also breathable, comfortable, and durable. And of course, not to mention sporting our public radio pride while you protect yourself and others from the spread of COVID-19. Donate $5 a month, at wuwm.com/give or by calling 877-583-0309. And we thank you for your donation. Coming up next, we'll speak with Lois Lowry, author of the classic novel, The Giver. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This past year has been extraordinary in so many ways. The pandemic, the recession, and the impending election have created an endless news cycle that at times seems surreal, like something out of a book. For author Lois Lowry, this moment in history is oddly reminiscent of her own work, like The Giver, a young adult dystopian novel which explores a world that prizes conformity above all else. Or Number the Stars. That's a novel set in Nazi-occupied Denmark and tells the story of a Jewish family forced to escape their home due to their political persecution. But while the topic of her books is often dark, Lowry says she believes in happy endings, which is perhaps why she's joining the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee to give a lecture titled Dwelling in Possibility. Before the event this Saturday, Lowry joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about this historical moment and her work.
This last year has been, I think, very interesting, to say the least. As a writer who really deals in, you know, complex themes, especially for a young audience, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this moment that we're living through right now. Do you see parallels between your work and this moment in history?
Oh boy, that's a complex question, and I'm going to give you a lot of credit for dreaming it up. Whether I can come up with a complex answer, I don't know. I will say that you're of course right. This has been a very different, unusual, and difficult year. As a writer, though, as a person who is a writer, I am accustomed to isolation. I'm a very solitary person who spends my time sitting alone in a room, putting words on, used to be a piece of paper, of course, now it's into a computer. So my life has not, in that regard, changed very much. But I write for young people, and I hear from young people, and I have grandchildren, and I'm aware of how their lives have changed and what a loss this has brought to them in terms of their relationship to other people. My life when I was a teenager and my grandchildren's lives, now they're in college, consist of their relationships with friends, romantic relationships at a time, of course, when I was a teenager, that was true and still is today. And now they're so alone and solitary. And so that's been a tremendous adjustment for them. And I think that will affect them for years to come. As I say, my life has not changed that much, except I will say my husband came down with COVID. He went off in an ambulance from our house on April 4th. And I was not able to see him again until he was released from the hospital on June 24th. And I haven't added it up, but that's about 10 weeks. And I could talk to him on the phone, but often he was very difficult to understand because he was so ill and so drugged. So that was a particularly horrible period of time for me. He's now home. And he's recovering, but it's a long, slow recovery with a lot of after effects. So in that regard, that's something that has affected me and will continue to. But as I was saying, it's the young people that I care about. I'm 83, and my husband's 88. He will be next month. So we're not going to be around that much longer. But it's the kids, my grandchildren, that I worry about. What is their future going to be like? And of course, this is a very difficult time politically as well. And I shouldn't take a political stance on public radio. But I will say this, whatever your political views are, this is a very stressful and difficult time. And that's going to have an effect for years to come, long after I'm gone. So I worry about that too. I spend an inordinate amount of time worrying about teenagers, even though I am no longer one, and my kids are grown, and even my youngest grandchild is now 19. But it's those younger ones, the ones who are 11, 12, and 13, that I worry about in such a formative time of their lives in a world that has just kind of fallen apart in so many ways. I just hope it gets put back together in ways that will be beneficial to these kids.
First, I'd like to say I'm so sorry to hear about your husband, but I'm glad that he's on the road to recovery.
He lost 30 pounds. I wish it had been me that had lost 30 pounds. But yes, he's getting better slowly.
Good. You know, looking at especially that age range that you're talking about, younger teens, one of the big themes of your books, specifically The Giver, is this idea of being the same as one another, which is a really interesting concept to explore right now because our country is so divided in many ways, as you yourself just, you know, alluded to. Has this idea of conformity become more potent in a culture where our differences are so divisive?
Gosh, and that's an unanswerable question. I don't know the answer to it, but I think back to my own years of being in that formative time of 11, 12, 13, when you're trying to figure out who you are and who you're going to be, trying to separate from your parents without being alienated from them, and trying to find your place in the world of your peers. And of course, you're quite right that kids of that age work so hard at being the same as their peers, at the same time that they need to find their own individuality. Whatever the circumstances are in the larger world, I think this is always the thing with kids. But nowadays, of course, they're isolated from their peers. And also something that did not exist in my adolescence, thank goodness, I think now, is, how can I describe it in one word, the media. There were no computers when I was young. There was no internet. So there was none of that immediate access that is so much a part of the lives of our kids now. And in some ways, it makes their lives better at the same time that it has a certain corrupting influence, I'm afraid. We've got so many things to work out in this country, in this world. And, you know, for me, my role in it is the writer of books, presenting these issues to kids without pretending to be able to answer them. But I think books of the sort that I write do play the role of presenting the questions and making them available to kids for discussion. And even in today's school situation, where a lot of their education is taking place virtually, still teachers are using books like mine and others to present these issues and to initiate discussions with kids. I hear from teachers all the time, again, by the internet, by email, and they tell me about the interesting, particularly the book The Giver. It's often used in schools in seventh and eighth grade. I just had an email from a teacher who was kind of pissed off because she's sixth grade. She had always used The Giver, and this year her school has decided to use it in seventh grade, and she doesn't get to teach it. But she talked about what a wonderful vehicle it was for thought and for discussion and debate. And those are things that it's hard to initiate with kids at that age. They want to be in agreement with all their friends, and then they're presented with these issues where they're up for discussion. And teachers love having a vehicle like that. And I'm very honored always to hear that I've been able to provide that.
I will say that was about the age that I was when I read The Giver. I was about sixth or seventh grade. When you look at the moment in history that we are experiencing, which of your books would you say resonates most with this moment?
Which of my books?
Yes.
I suppose I would have to say The Giver, because it deals with a time in the not terribly distant future when the world has changed. And of course, we're at a time when the world is changing. The Giver is one of a quartet of books, and there are three that follow it. One of those four books, the second one called Gathering Blue, is also set in the same future time, but in a different location. In The Giver, the community where the boy lives is very sophisticated in terms of its technology. But in the second book, in a different location, they've lost all their technology. That book is called Gathering Blue. Live in a very primitive fashion. And each year they're required to listen to a recitation of the history of their world. And in that ceremony, it's described an occasion when tall buildings fell and burned. And it's clearly a representation of 9/11. And yet the astonishing thing is that the book was written before that happened, which gives me a weird feeling of being prescient in some way. Then in the third book, same time period, different community, a very pleasant place where everybody gets along, and it's made up largely of immigrants, people who have come there from other places. And in that book, the community divides and factions are formed because one group wants to build a wall to keep out any further immigration. So again, it's oddly related to things that are happening now, though it was written a number of years ago. So any of these books are related to what's happening now. And at the same time, there's another book I've written that is not as well known, and it's called Like the Willow Tree. And that's a book that is part of a series published by Scholastic called the Dear America series. I was asked to write this book, and each of those books, written by different authors, is in the voice of a child who is on the periphery of some historic event in this country. And so I was asked to write about the flu epidemic of 1918. I wrote this book probably, 10 years ago. And they've just decided to republish it with a new cover on it, because of course I did a lot of research to write the book, but so much of what happened is being echoed now at that time, and in the voice of the child talking about her family. Her father's angry because people are closing down their stores. He is still going to work every day, but he thinks it's foolish that people are not going to work, and she's upset because her birthday's coming up, and she'd been told that she could go to the movies for her birthday. And movies, of course, were a big deal in 1918, very new. And so she was excited about that. But now the movie theaters are closed down. And so everybody's life is affected in the same ways that they're affected now. And of course, there's tragedy involved as well. So a number of my books, whatever form they take, are oddly related to these times. But I think of all of them, probably The Giver would be the one that is most related. And it in part has to do, the thing that kids take away from it is the fact that this world of the future has been created by people who, in making, I suppose, political decisions, had made compromises and had compromised on important things with a bad outcome. And so it alerts kids to the importance of decisions and political decisions. And peripherally then, of course, I hope it alerts them to the importance of voting, which is such an issue right now.
The speech that you'll be giving virtually here in Milwaukee is really all about hope and possibility. What does that mean to you? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I interrupted you. I'm sorry. But even though we deal with such difficult issues, I have always been a writer who looked for, at the end of a book, a happy ending. The Giver ends ambiguously. And you don't know when you finish reading it whether the boy, the protagonist, is alive or dead. But if you read the further books, you'll find that he's alive. I've always believed in happy endings. And even now, in these difficult times, I do think we'll come through it, because we always do. I hope we'll come through it stronger and better. But part of what I try to write about is resilience, that we need to hang in there, fight for what's right, and come through with a positive ending on the other side.
For you, what are some of the things that you've been focusing on right now, looking at what's possible and moving forward from that point?
Well, I have to think. It's curious, because I'm working on a new book right now, and it's set in a distant previous time period. A lot of research involved, but I've been living in that time period instead of this one. And maybe that's a kind of denial and avoidance, because it's so difficult to be in this time period. But I think, in answer to your question, the thing that I would focus on, and that I hope kids are going to be able to, is getting through it and maintaining optimism. That's the hard part sometimes, I think. It's so easy to just fall into despair and think this will never end. And yet, of course, it will. The book set in 1918 makes that clear. The book transpires over the course of a year. And of course, that epidemic ended eventually. It ended and left a lot of tragedy behind, as this is, but it did end. And so I think that's the thing to focus on, that there will be an ending, a resolution, a moving forward. And so I think optimism is what I try to focus on and to give to kids.
Well, Lois Lowry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Okay, I'm really looking forward to, I was looking forward to being in Milwaukee, and now, of course, I'm not going to be, but I feel as though I am, because I'll be with people. I've been doing a lot of these virtual events, and you can convince yourself that you're there in that crowd of little rectangles with faces. And so I'm looking forward to my time with Milwaukee.
Well, we're looking forward to having you.
Thank you.
Lois Lowry is an author best known for her books The Giver and Number the Stars, for which she won the Newbery Medal. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and Lowry will be presenting a virtual lecture for the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee this Saturday, October 3rd. And it's interviews like this one with Lois Lowry that is unique to programs like Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, and it is day 3 of our fall member drive. We are looking for one-time donations, sustaining members, new members, all across the board. We need your support to keep programming like Lake Effect, like Morning Edition, and all of the other programs you rely on throughout the day to stay on the air and to stay current. You can do that by calling 877-583-0309, or you can go online to wuwm.com/give. You can also donate by going on the WUWM app and hitting the red donate button. It takes only a few moments of your day to ensure many more quality listener moments on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. So give now, and we thank you for your contribution. We'll take one last break and then get a firsthand account of caring for COVID-19 patients. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There have now been more than 7 million cases of COVID-19 in the United States, and more than 200,000 people have died from complications related to the virus. In Wisconsin this week, we saw a record number of deaths in a day and a record number of people who are hospitalized as cases spike across the state. Respiratory therapist Niu Tao knows firsthand what it's like to work in those conditions. The MATC graduate volunteered to work at a hospital in East Orange, New Jersey, when cases began to spike there earlier in the pandemic. East Orange is a suburb of New York City and one of the hardest hit areas in the nation. Tao spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and we'd like to warn you that some descriptions are graphic and may disturb some listeners.
So what first brought you to the East Coast? Why did you decide to go?
You know, I was in the middle of transitioning from a children's hospital to the adult world. And, you know, this opportunity came up with the COVID crisis. And I figured, what better time to get the adult experience than now? But besides that, you know, I've always loved the East Coast, especially in New York City. I've been going there for many, many years. And as a matter of fact, a lot of my friends call me New York. And, you know, this opportunity came up with New Jersey, and I kind of jumped on it. And even though I have just under a year experience, they were willing to take a chance with me. So I was thrilled about the opportunity to help.
So set the scene for us. What were things like there when you first arrived?
When I first arrived, it was pretty busy. There were a lot of positive cases of COVID-19 and a handful of admissions all coming at once. It was a bit overwhelming. Lots of coding, cardiac arrest, people not surviving, lots of deaths. So pretty scary time.
What was that like? I mean, you know, you said you had about a year of experience. Had you seen anything quite like that?
No, never before. Before taking on this assignment, I was at Children's Hospital, and there, you know, maybe once a blue moon you see a death, but when arriving to New Jersey, it was a very different story. Lots of sick patients with cardiac arrest and not being able to save. Honestly, I've never seen so many deaths before.
Yeah. A lot of people here haven't necessarily seen someone with COVID-19, especially a very severe case like that. Can you describe what patients experience or what they looked like in these circumstances?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I don't know how it is here in Wisconsin, but out there on the East Coast, a lot of the COVID patients that we were seeing were in extreme respiratory distress, meaning deprived of oxygen, not able to breathe on their own, breathing very fast and rapidly. The majority of them are being intubated, meaning having to have a breathing machine do the work for them. And a lot of times they don't make it back alive. The lungs are not functioning very well, and the machine is breathing for them. A lot of times they're extremely sedated and not alert at all. Lots of secretions.
When you say secretions, what do you mean?
Yeah, from what I experienced out there, our patients were foaming at the mouth. So basically, there were so much fluid in their lungs that with a machine breathing for them, we can only do so much as far as suctioning goes. The secretion is basically just buildup of fluid that is coming back out of their mouth. And so it's just been a lot of nonstop suctioning and trying to get that out as much as possible. Very rare will you see someone make it out alive in a situation like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Because with all those secretions, it also affects the heart. When there's so much fluid backed up in your heart and lungs, eventually your heart is working so hard, eventually it gives out. And that's where you find the cardiac arrest.
Yeah. How would you describe what a typical day looked like for you when you were working at the hospital?
Yes, in the beginning it was very chaotic. 1 minute there's, you know, 2 or 3 admissions in the ER to running to the ICU to try to resuscitate someone whose heart has stopped, to running to another room to try to resuscitate someone else whose heart has stopped. We also draw blood to check oxygen levels, so we were doing a lot of running around for that. It was hard to hear because the PPE that was provided is not your average PPE. It is, you're wearing a respirator mask along with a goggle, a face shield, a white suit, TVEC suit that covers your ears. It's very hard to hear what others are saying or trying to communicate to you. So you really have to pay attention beyond your toes and communicate effectively. So it was very hot, hard to breathe. I was just drenched by every round that I would complete. I would just be completely drenched in my own sweat. It was rough.
Wow. You know, it sounds like something you'd see in a movie of, you know, a pandemic, which of course is what we're in.
Yes.
When patients came to the hospital, were you able to take care of everyone? Were there lines? Was everyone in a bed?
Yes, for the most part they were. And if the bed was not available, they were in the ER waiting for a bed to be available. But also, we were separating non-COVID patients from COVID patients. And with the COVID patients, if the room was big enough, we would put 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 patients in one room.
Wow.
Yes, and I haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah. How did things evolve while you were working there? You know, you said at the beginning it was very chaotic. Did that get easier as time went on?
It did. Within, I would say, 4 weeks, I wouldn't say it started improving, but the admissions, the COVID cases, admissions were slowing down quite a bit. And then from there, we were able to care for our patients that are there currently without running around too much. So yeah, the cases definitely slowed down and we were able to manage more as time went on, for sure.
You know, COVID-19 infections here have started to rise once again. Does that concern you?
It does. Coming from New Jersey and New York, I feel like some of the people here are not taking it as serious. I know when I was there for 8 weeks, everybody was wearing a mask, whether they're walking their dog or riding their bike or just walking around the neighborhood. Everyone was taking precautions. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with the severity of the cases out there. So that was the norm for the last 8 weeks. When I returned home, it was very different. It was kind of hard to believe that everybody is still acting as if things are normal. The truth is, restaurants have to open, businesses have to open, you know, we have to get back to living again. But I think this is the new norm and everyone should still take precaution. And I think this is probably going to be the new norm for a long time.
Yeah. As you mentioned, there are people who are acting like everything's normal, who are going about their lives, not wearing masks, not, you know, washing their hands incessantly as many others of us are. If you were talking to someone who is a skeptic, someone who doesn't think this is a real problem, what's a story from your experience that you'd want them to hear?
Yeah, I would probably tell them that this is very, very real. I've experienced it for myself. I don't know if you know, but I had gotten really sick, Joy, and the first 2 weeks that I was there, I had gotten really, really ill, and I wasn't sure if it was COVID or not, but I was running a fever. I was showing some symptoms, but I was in denial. I'm thinking I'm young, I'm tough, you know, there's no way I could have gotten COVID already. But I did collapse in the hotel elevator. And at that moment, I thought I was dying. I seriously had no idea what happened, but I know I blacked out and I hit my head, was bleeding. I was rushed to the hospital. Now, whatever that was, I survived it. They are assuming it is COVID. But with that being said, yes, I would probably share my experience and say, you know what? I took all precautions while I was working at the hospital and when I was at the hotel, and I still got sick. They assumed it was COVID, so I'm just going to accept that. So I would probably share with them my experience among the experience that I faced while working at the hospital, and hopefully that will, I don't know, bring some sense to a couple of people.
Well, Nu, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your experiences. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you. You're welcome.
Nu Tao is an MATC graduate and a respiratory therapist who has been on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in July. And right now, we are in day 3 of our fall member drive. Thank you for donating if you have done so already. And if you haven't, well, you can go online to wuwm.com/give, or you can call 877-583-0309 to continue supporting the work that you value listening to every day. And every time you have turned to WUWM for information, you have heard listener dollars at work. So be part of this work now with your contribution at wuwm.com/give. You can go to the red donate button on our app, or you can do that by calling 877-583-0309. That's today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.